Games and Libraries podcast for September 2009. Hi there, this is Scott Nicholson from Syracuse University School of Information Studies. Welcome to the Games and Libraries podcast for September 2009. Now, we got a reminder coming up. National Gaming Day in your library is right around the corner. It's going to be November 14th, 2009. And what we're trying to do is on that day, trying to get as many libraries to participate in games as possible. We will have some surveys after the fact for you to tell us how many people played in the games so we can get some data on how many people went to libraries on that day and played games. For more information for your patrons, you can go to ilovelibraries.org/gaming, or you can go to connect.ala.org to the Games and Gaming Members Initiative Group, where there's a discussion forum there on National Gaming Day 2009, NGD 2009. There'll be more information about this in next month's podcast, but at least you can mark the date and get a program set up. On this month's show, we're first going to hear from Donald Dennis from Georgetown County Library System, where he and his graduate assistant, Thomas Malook, are going to talk about websites for video game reviews. After that, I'm going to be on, and I'm going to talk briefly about Wii Sports Resort and the Wii Motion Plus controller and let you know what I think about it. Julie Scordato is going to talk about the teen gaming initiative that she's been working on at Columbus, Ohio Metropolitan Library. Beth Galloway will come on and tell a little bit about what she's doing with YALSA. She's teaching a gaming class through YALSA starting next month. And then I'll be back on, and I'm going to introduce 1,000 Blank White Cards, which is the game of the month for the Games and Gamies Members Initiative Group. If you would, if you're listening to this, please tell a friend about the show. The best way this show gets passed around is through word of mouth. You can find all the information you need over at gamesandlibraries.org. So without further ado, let's get on with the show.
I'm Donald Dennis, and I'm here with
Thomas,
and we're going to talk a little bit today about game review sites. Previously, I did a segment here on the Games and Libraries podcast for board game podcasts, and today we're going to talk about websites having to do with video games and why you may not want to go to the Game Informer every time you're looking for information on video games. Would you agree with that statement?
Yes. Game Informer, for example, is owned by GameStop. So it's in their best interest to give certain games a high review so that GameStop can sell more of them.
You mean they're not looking out for the consumer every time you turn around?
They'll tell you if the graphics look sweet.
Okay. All right.
They'll say, oh, I'll admit this one small fault of this game. I'll give it an 8.5.
Actually, I guess that's a good idea. Let's talk about game ratings in general. Pretty much on a 10-point scale, the bottom of the scale is almost never used.
7 is almost unforgivable, and everything beneath that, why would you want to spend your money on an average game?
On an average.
You want to play a great game.
Exactly. If you see anything that's living in the lower half of the spectrum for video game ratings, it's probably a game you want to avoid unless it fits a specific collection demand for your library.
Yes.
All right. So now that being said, there are different kinds of video game review sites. We talked about one that's owned by a store or that's part of a store franchise, the Game Informer. What other kinds of video game review sites are there?
Well, the kind that I usually use are called aggregate review sites. And that means that they pull in reviews from multiple sources, and then they give you an average score. So something like Metacritic, Game Rankings, and then you showed me Moby Games.
Yep.
They pull in reviews from multiple official sources, quote unquote. And that way you can get an idea of, just like with looking at movie reviews, you can say, for the people who loved it the most, why did they love it? For the people who didn't like it, why did they not like it? Where would I fit in?
Well, and that's what I was going to ask. If, say, 75% of the well-known game review sites out there are owned or affiliated somehow with a sales branch or some kind of money-making opportunity, how can you trust any of them? Or what difference does it make if it's an aggregated site or if it's just one site that's putting up their reviews?
Because these critics may all have different motives. I don't think a game studio can pay off every critic. And most of these sites also follow up by letting users post their reviews. So you can see reviews from critics and users saying, here's a role-playing game. It's not a 10. It's not perfect. But if you like RPGs, this is the game for you.
Which actually brings me to another point about video game reviews, or reviews in general. Because video games have so many different styles and categories, it's not uncommon that someone gets a hold of a video game and that's not the kind of game they play. So I'm a party gamer or a puzzle gamer, but you've just given me a first-person shooter. I'm going to hate it. Even though there is an inflation of skills, of scores, because of payoffs to support the sites or whatever it is, there's also, you need to look and see why people don't like games. Don't take one review. If you go to one review site all the time and you really like what that reviewer likes, then maybe you can judge by that. But if you're with a new reviewer and they hate a game, try and figure out why they hate it.
Especially with retro titles, the Xbox, PlayStation, and Wii all have these emulation services, more or less, and reviewers have to play catch-up with a previous generation of games. And video games in the old days were harder. You had a few lives, and you got game over, and you started back from square one. There were no save states. There were fewer power-ups. And so when an older game gets a negative score, it's important to find out, is it bad compared to today's games, or is it just a little trickier, but it's ultimately rewarding?
And yeah, I agree with that 100%. Oh, if it is, if you do need to go to Game Informer, or if that's where you're looking at the top reviews, the first paragraph will tell you almost all of the good stuff about a game. And if the reviewer wants to be truthful, even though their magazine or their backer says, these are people we have to be nice to, look farther in to find out and say, well, there might be some camera control issues. Which, if other people are rating the game low for camera and this person mentions it as well, it may mean that half the game's not visible because you can't get the camera in the right place.
And a lot of big review sites will also do video reviews. And if you can dig into those, it's very useful to see this is what the game looks like in action. If it looks like it's a fun game to play, it probably is. But make sure it's gameplay and not just a bunch of cutscenes that are supposed to look like the best part of the game.
Or just screenshots or anything along those lines. All right, so you mentioned specifically Metacritic, which is one that I've gone to for CDs and video game reviews. What's great about that, besides the fact it's an aggregator? Is there anything else specific about it you really like?
Metacritic is an aggregate site that asks its critics to prove themselves to Metacritic first. They say, show us your site, show us some of your reviews and the quality of your writing, then we'll include you on our lists, and you can help us determine scores. And Metacritic's gotten so important at this point to how gamers choose games that I believe it was at Electronic Arts, there was a memo that was leaked about game directors' salaries being linked to their Metacritic scores. Because EA knew if you could get a score of 80 or higher, tons of people will buy it. Because the 1 to 10 system is flawed, 8 means buy it. 7 and below means you might be throwing your money away. But also, I think Metacritic's pretty good at bringing in reviews as soon as they come in. And they also have the release dates for items that aren't out yet. So it's a good way to look at what's going to come out on Tuesday. What can I get? And see if there are some advanced reviews if you want to be an early adopter. The Metascore is the aggregate score. If one person gives a game 100 and the other a 50, the game will have an official score of 75.
Now, do certain people get higher impact on that, or is it just a...
Every critic's review is averaged in equally.
Okay.
And users are also allowed to post their reviews, but those are factored at a completely different score.
Right.
So you could see if there was a conspiracy among critics, you would see a game that had an 85 from all the critics and they loved it, but you would see the user rating and it got a 4, you know there's something funny going on.
Yep.
You'd say, well, everybody selling the game loves it, everybody playing the game hates it.
Oh, yeah, that's another thing I was going to say, is when you've got access to one of these cool sites that aggregate scores, is check out a couple from the high, a couple from the medium, and a couple from the low. Don't just look at the best and the worst. And in fact, I'd say don't look at the top 5 and don't look at the bottom 5. Say there were 100 people. You know, pick some of the ones from the higher ups, but not necessarily the best ones, because those are the raving fanboys. And then don't pick the ones at the very bottom, because they're irrational haters who generally don't like anything. But, you know, I could be wrong.
Or they may have misinterpreted the game, or they're not the target audience, so to speak.
Exactly. And then, yeah, you mentioned GameRankings.com, and you said that one's a little different because anyone can contribute. It's just a broader scope.
Well, they have a somewhat wider breadth.
Okay. Well, so that's three sites that we've hit on briefly. One, GameRankings.com, Metacritic.com, and Moby Games, which we haven't talked about yet. But Moby Games has a bunch of different reviews, but they're also trying to catalog all the video games. So it's not just new games that get up there. If you find an old game, you can still submit it. And get it put up there. So I think that's another great site, especially if you have a classic video game collection or you're trying to build one for your library. So check them out. And are there any other sites you think that they should avoid, or is there a reason to really avoid a video game review site?
What I would recommend to find out if you can trust a review site, look up games that you've played before. Look up your favorite games. Look up games that have really let you down and see if those critics agree with you. And if they see eye to eye with you, then follow them.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to this review of review sites. I'm Donald Dennis.
I'm Thomas. I give game review sites a 92.
Hi, this is Scott Nicholson, and I want to give you my take on Wii Sports Resort. So the idea of Wii Sports Resort is it's a game that comes with a new controller accessory, the Wii Motion Plus. And what this is a little square box that hooks to the bottom of your Wiimote. Now, when you buy this, you'll get the game. You'll also get a new remote protector, and the protector is larger to accommodate the little square box. And so the idea is that you take it out of the old protector, you plug it into the box, plug it into the new protector. So the wrist strap now comes out kind of near the bottom, but not at the bottom of the Wiimote. And then you can hook the nunchuck up just as easily. So this lets one person play the game. Now, the game's going to cost about $50, but now to play the game with four people, you're going to have to buy three more of these Motion Plus things. And so that's going to be another $20 each or $60. So you're looking at over $100 to get set up for four players on Wii Sports Resort. Is it worth it? Well, here's some things to think about. The Wiimote becomes much more controllable. If you've ever played with the Wii, it might have gotten frustrating in that you feel that the Wii doesn't really map what you're doing very well. And what this new little device does is it really helps you track your motion much more effectively. The game itself is a mixture. It's just like Wii Sports. There's a number of different things you can do. Some are better than others. I found the most fun one to be swordplay. And in swordplay, you're actually having duels with other people, either virtual people or real people, as you're swinging your Wii Motion Plus remote around. And so it actually does track. It's like you're holding the sword, and where you swing is where you swing. That's a lot of fun. It improves tennis and bowling quite a bit. And so those are games that are... It improves golf and bowling quite a bit. If you've had people that have enjoyed Wii Bowling, and you have a Wii Bowling program, it would probably be worth it because you can really put a spin on the ball. It maps much better to your hand as to what's going on. It's got a number of other events as well. You've got canoeing and cycling and wakeboarding and things like that. And, you know, they're okay, but they're not as immersive. Archery is fun. And so that's a pretty neat addition where you're aiming at a target. And table tennis gives you a much improved experience over like tennis from old Wii Sports. So in table tennis, you're actually getting spin on the ball and all that stuff. So there's some good stuff that can work well in your library. There's other games that aren't so great. But overall, I'd say if you either have patrons that are really enjoy golf or bowling and you want to improve their experience, or you want to give people a chance to try out this new thing. Because if you say you were doing a Wii Sports Resort day, you're going to draw people to the library who are wondering if they want to buy it. And that's a good thing. So if you're using your Wii for marketing purposes, you may want to use this as a chance to bring people in. Then you can have some of your other gaming activities out to expose people to the types of gaming they can do at the library. So Wii Sports Resort, I'll give it a maybe. You gotta, if one of those situations appeals to you, then go for it. If otherwise, I might say wait and see what happens with the Motion Plus, if other games begin to pick it up or not. We're seeing some games already give you the option to use it, but we're not yet seeing a large-scale adoption of it. So it may end up being just another one of Nintendo's overpriced little gimmicky bits. But that's my own opinion. If you've got your opinion, come on over to connect.ala.org and you can talk about what you've found to be true with Wii Sports Resort. That's all, and I'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Hi, my name is Julie Scordato, and I am the Youth Services Leader, Specialization Teen Services, for the Columbus Metropolitan Library in Columbus, Ohio. And today I want to talk about the continued advocacy for gaming once the shine wears off. But before I get to that main point, let me give you some background on what CML, Columbus Metropolitan Library, has done with gaming. In March 2007, we unrolled gaming system-wide across our 21 locations to celebrate the first National Teen Tech Week. to Unroll Gaming, we kicked off First National Teen Tech Week by having every single location hold at least one open gaming. And what we offered was Guitar Hero and Dance Dance Revolution on PlayStation. We were able to offer all of this equipment and programming through our 21 locations because our administration and our board of trustees really embraced the idea of meeting teenagers where they are and using technology that's a part of their daily life and pursuing programming that allows opportunities to build casual relationships where the library staff are facilitators rather than presenters, and able to talk with the teens on a one-on-one basis and take some of the pressure off that adult-teen relationship that they're so used to in other structured youth programs. We had nearly 400 teens participate in 1 week for Teen Tech Week 2007. We continued to do open gaming throughout 2007, and in July, our second installment of gaming equipment provided all 21 locations with a Nintendo Wii and three extra controllers so 4 players could participate in a game. And we also supplied each location with a copy of Wii Sports to go along with the Wii. And we also gave each branch, I think it was $260 to spend on their own for other games or an extra console if they wish. So it was a very large upfront investment. Columbus Metropolitan Library essentially invested over $20,000 in gaming equipment for the year 2007. Now, what we got out of that investment was nearly 15,000 teens participating in gaming to date in less than 3 years for our gaming programs. We have gained an enormous amount of cross-participation. Teens who have come to gaming programs and then have become volunteers or have joined or started book groups or went on to participate in other library activities. We have seen teens who have had discipline problems and behavioral problems in the past with library staff improve their behavior, improve their respect with library staff, and overall improve their perception of the library. We have spent less money in subsequent years after that upfront investment. We give each branch a certain amount of money each year, which has fluctuated with the budget. And we let the branches really determine what their customers want. What, you know, one branch, Guitar Hero, is the big thing, so they spend more of their budget money on Rock Band and updated Guitar Hero games. Another branch, you know, chose to buy a second Xbox, so because Xbox was so popular at their branch. So we do leave the yearly spending up to the discretion of the branches. And even as funding shrinks, we still make room for branches to have $200, $250 to purchase replacement equipment and new games. So that's the basic overview of what Columbus Metropolitan Library is doing in terms of gaming equipment. We are part of the GT system, tournament system out of Ann Arbor, and are currently in the process of developing best practices and trainings for using the tournament software for so many locations. And this is something that we will be sharing as we go and as we make further progress, considering all the variables of, you know, 21 locations doing tournament play. So what I want to talk about now is this idea that gaming is reaching what I think is a critical point in our libraries and in the field. It seems to me that we're getting past that gee whiz, hey, wow, isn't this cool stage, and we're getting into the stage where we can either have gaming really be accepted or people can develop not a negative attitude but an indifferent attitude. And sometimes indifference is harder to work with. I think that as resources continue to shrink in this economy and libraries face tougher and tighter budgets, gaming which seem to make sense and have really great results and, you know, provide experiences that even the most negative library staff would still need convincing. You know, at this point, we need to advocate for gaming now that the shine has worn off a little bit and remind our colleagues and our administrators and our board that the results of gaming do not change, that even if there's less money to spend on programming, even if there's less money to spend on gaming, the investment is worth it. You can get miles and miles and miles out of a console. You can have teens bring games from home. You can work with your local game stores and local gaming clubs to partner up to share resources. But no matter what the dollar amount is, the bottom line with gaming is that it provides a universal experience that allows teens of all socioeconomic and cultural backgrounds to enjoy and play together and participate together. It allows teen services staff a chance to provide a program with extremely low preparation time and extremely high results, and also a program where teenagers can participate and volunteer to facilitate and help the library staff with the program. It's a program that allows non-teen services staff to facilitate and have successful interactions with the teen customers in their library. It's a vehicle to bring new teenagers into your branches and encourage repeat visits and improve the behavior and general relations with staff. None of these outcomes change when budgets shrink. And so I think as a gaming advocate, one always needs to be on the alert for when we start to look at budgets and so-and-so says, oh, gaming, it's so expensive. You know, remind them, you know, divide the amount of money that you have spent on gaming by the number of participants, by the number of repeat visitors, if you've been keeping track of that. If you haven't, I highly recommend that you try. And track those anecdotes. Track that teenager that a library staff person helped find a book for them based on a conversation they were able to have in a casual context of gaming. Point out those two teenagers who have had so many evictions coming in every week helping with gaming. When the shine wears off of new projects and new initiatives, it's often our role to not fall into indifference ourselves and take anything for granted. And we need to always be telling the teen services story and the gaming story and reminding people that, you know, that PlayStation that you bought used at your local gaming store has, you know, averaged out $1.50 a teen, $2 a teen in usage. Remind people what the real numbers are and what the real figures are, and work with the Lib Gaming folks and the ALA toolkit to find out ways that you can continue to offer gaming in times of less budget. Show that not only that you are resourceful, but that gaming does not have to be a high-ticket item. And most of all, no matter how much your library spends on gaming, the results stay the same. The results are extremely positive and varied. Thank you.
This is Beth Galloway with a quick plug. YALSA will offer 3 online classes in October: Aiming at Tweens, Advising, Involving, Motivating, taught by Terry Lesesne; Graphic Novels and Teen Readers, The Basics and Beyond, taught by Francisca Goldsmith; and Reaching Teens with Gaming, taught by yours truly. Gaming at the library refers to card, board, role-playing, and big games, not just digital video games. Thinking about hosting board game nights or starting a circulating video game collection? Already offering Rock Band and Mario Kart and looking for a next step program? Would you like to engage RuneScape players, RPGers, or just use a big game to promote the library? These topics and more will be covered in this session. The main focus is to educate non-gamers about what games are and introduce librarians to the many formats of a hobby that engages the free time of their teen clientele. The session concludes with creating a plan of service to engage gamers at the library. The gaming course runs 6 weeks and has been recently revised and adapted to include multiple types of games, not just video games. Expect to spend 8 to 12 hours total on the coursework, playing games and responding to discussion board questions. All required readings are free and available online in text, audio, and/or video format, with many optional resources. The course is designed to bring the beginning gamer up to speed in weeks 1 and 2, and to be a review, to some extent, for those already doing gaming. The gaming and literacy connection is relatively new for everyone, and it never hurts to get a refresher in advocacy or establish a common vocabulary. In weeks 3 through 6, the course will offer creative solutions for intermediate and advanced gamers to take gaming to the next level while newbies get their feet wet. Strong focus is on services that support gamers, without librarians needing a lot of expertise or having to pick up a controller or pair of dice themselves. My intent is that those who are doing no gaming will try something new after the course is completed, and those who are doing gaming will go beyond a video game program once a month. Registration for all three online classes is now open. Sessions begin on October 5th, 2009. For more information or to register, go to www.ala.org/YALSA and click on the professional development link. And from there, you should see information about online courses. I hope to see many of you in Reaching Teens with Gaming online this fall.
Hi there, this is Scott Nicholson, and I'm here to introduce September's Game of the Month for you. Now, the Game of the Month Club, again, is something from the Games and Gaming Members Initiative Group out of ALA. What we're doing is we're picking a game each month, we're encouraging people to play the game, and then we're going to talk about it. And so you can find the discussion over in connect.ala.org, and you can see it in the Games and Gaming Members Initiative Group space. There'll be a link in the show notes. This month's game is 1,000 Blank White Cards. Now, this is an analog game, i.e. a card game. And what you're going to do in this game is play cards. It's a very inexpensive card game. In order to play, all you need are 20 blank cards for each player who wants to play and some markers, pens, and pencils. Now, these cards could be index cards. They could even be old card catalog cards if you sell stacks of those. This is a perfect game to use those with. What you do is you hand each player 15 blank white cards, and you tell them to draw a picture, name the card, and give it some sort of special feature if they wish. So what they can do is they can make the cards give you points. They can make the cards take away points. It's usually good to set a limit on the points. You might say nothing more than 100 points on any one card. You can make the cards have special effects, cancel someone else's card, or skip a player, or skip everyone else but me, or make someone stand up, turn around, and tell us their favorite song. You can have embarrassing party game type things. You know, think of a movie. If you can get people to guess that movie without speaking in 30 seconds, then you're going to get 100 points. So you could also do obscure cards like 42 or 3 of hearts or spam sandwiches, just because they're silly. Then what you do is you shuffle in those cards and you shuffle in another 5 blank white cards per player. Mix them up, give everyone 5 cards at the table. And now, on your turn, you play a card from your hand, then you draw your hand back up to 5. Now, you could make cards that change those rules, that say, oh, actually, you get to play 3 cards, and you draw your hand back up to 7, or draw your hand back up to 1. So there's ways to even change the rules with the cards that you create. Now, if you get a blank card when you're playing, you take the blank card and you make it. You add a name, you add a picture, and you add an effect. And so this is how the game can take on a flavor, because people will begin making certain types of cards. So you play until all the cards are run out, and then you stop and you score points, and then you see who the winner is, which hopefully is all of you because you're having fun playing the game. Then what you do is you take the deck, and the next time you want to play the game, you give everyone 5 cards, you ask them to fill out the 5 cards, you shuffle those up, and then you add another 15 cards for each player from this old deck. Mix them up, play the game with that. Then what will happen is over time, this deck will build, and people will have contributed to this legacy game that's sitting around the library. Now, every once in a while, the librarian will want to go in and weed through the cards and take out those cards that don't make sense or are breaking the game or something like that. But for the most part, you're going to create this cool deck that the people over the months of playing the game have created. What we'd like you to do now is try this game. Get some friends or family together, or get some library patrons together, get a stack of index cards or blank catalog cards, and give it a shot. See how it goes. Once you've tried it, go over to connect.ala.org and find the discussion board, or just go to the show notes for the show. You'll see the link to it there. And join us. Tell us what happened in your game. What kind of cards did people make? What was the surprise? Did the game take a tone as people begin creating their own cards? So chat with us about what went on. It can be a great way to learn about each other and learn about lots of different games through Play Along With Us. So have some fun, and we'll see you over at connect.ala.org. Thank you all for joining us for this month's podcast. This podcast is made possible by the generous support of the Verizon Foundation and thinkfinity.org. For more information, head over to gamesandlibraries.org. Thanks a lot, and we'll talk to you next month. Bye-bye.